All right, folks, we are moving on. I believe this is part 10. It's either 10 or 11. I'm pretty sure it's 10, though. Of On the Trail of the Assassins, we're picking up with chapter 19, entitled The Majesty of the Law. I am Ted Midward. My site is tedmidward.info. If you like this, if you enjoy this, please check out my site. If you can, send me a donation. Check out the other projects I do. You might find some of them of interest. Okay, let's jump into chapter 19. My arrests by federal agents came without warning. It was early in the morning, June 30th, 1971. I had just had breakfast and read the Times-Picayune. I was still wearing my pajamas and bathrobe and was going up the stairs when the bell rang. I opened the door and the men from the federal government poured in. The man in charge displayed an Internal Revenue Service badge and held out a piece of paper, while other agents crowded in behind him. As they fanned out through the rest of the house, he informed me that I was under arrest and asked if I was armed. "How can I be armed when I'm just going upstairs to get dressed?" I said. "Well, we're going up with you because we have to take you downtown to book you." After I had dressed, with several agents closely watching me, I came down the stairs. My wife and children were very upset. I told them there was nothing to worry about. As I went out the front door, flanked by federal agents, I was appalled to see that the sidewalks and the driveway in the vicinity of the house were filled with new cars bearing large aerials. Men with walkie-talkies seemed to be all over the place. I noticed some neighbors peering out from their windows, and I could not blame them. Suddenly, I was embarrassed. I was taken downtown to the federal courthouse in a car packed full of agents. There, I was mugged, fingerprinted, and put behind bars in a green-walled holding cell. Soon, a guard brought me to a courtroom where the magistrate read the formal charges. It seemed that I stood accused of participating in organized crime, specifically of allowing payoffs on pinball gambling. It's hardly a novelty to hear a man who has been charged by the government say that he was innocent, but for me to say merely that I was innocent would be an understatement of cosmic dimensions. Put aside that I had never taken a single illegal dollar as district attorney, and that it simply was not in my makeup to do so. The plain fact was, as members of my staff and district attorneys of nearby parishes all realized, that I had enforced the law forbidding payoffs on pinball gambling more rigidly than any previous district attorney ever had. I had done this not because of any soaring sense of virtue or any particular rage about pinball payoffs, but because I used my office to enforce every criminal law on the books, whether it was a felony or, with pinball payoffs, a misdemeanor. The federal government apparently had not realized this, assuming that, like many of the district attorneys in Louisiana, I kept one eye closed to the pinball gambling payoffs. It had chosen this particular charge, I quickly figured out, because pinball gambling had a federal aspect, and this was in its jurisdiction. The federal connection was pretty slender, resting solely on the fact that the pinball machines were manufactured in Illinois. But without such strained legal reasoning, the government could come up with no reason to arrest me, unless, of course, it had announced the real reason, which I assumed was that I had caused considerable trouble to everyone by investigating the JFK assassination. After I was released on my own recognizance, Frank Klein picked me up and drove me to the office. Once the initial excitement was over, it was a normal day, except that I had made a long-distance call to Boston to talk to F. Lee Bailey, the distinguished trial attorney who was a friend of mine. Lee said he would be delighted and honored to represent me, but there would be one stipulation. "What?" I asked him. "There will be no fee," he replied to me. The 26 months between my arrest and my trial were filled, as always, with trying to keep an understaffed and underfinanced office caught up with the endless overload of work. From time to time, I had to appear as the defendant in the local United States District Court for my own pre-trial proceedings. Bailey's associates were excellent lawyers, and their preparation and court work during this period were splendid, to say the least, leaving me free to concentrate on the details of the district attorney's office. As time went on, however, it became apparent to all of us that the government was in no particular hurry to bring this case to trial. This simply gave us all the more time to study the material we had obtained from the government, as enunciated by the Supreme Court in the leading case of Brady v. Maryland. The federal government is required, during pre-trial discovery proceedings, to supply a criminal defendant with copies of all requested material relating to his case. In my case, that material turned out to be the prodigious revealing that the government's investigation of me, involving more than 40 IRS agents from 5 southern states, had been underway for several years, at the very least. The agent's primary problem had been to make it appear that I was in violation of some law. They had not been able to do this by the usual means of gathering statements from individuals in the pinball business, because no one in that business actually knew me. Accordingly, the federal agents handling my case appeared to have concluded that their only alternative was to create a make-believe case against me. As most students of covert operations will recognize, the intelligence community is not above constructing such a case against a target individual when circumstances require. The centerpiece of the government's case turned out to be my old wartime buddy, Pershing Gervais. It may be recalled that Gervais was once my chief investigator and had come into conflict with Frank Klein over the Kennedy investigation. I had dropped Gervais from the office staff after an attorney informed me that Gervais had offered to get a particular case dismissed for him for $750 cash. Although Gervais strongly denied the allegation, my position was that the DA's office had to be like Caesar's wife. It was not enough for the office to be virtuous. Its virtue had to be unquestioned. Reluctant to accuse my old army friend of lying and also reluctant to fire him, I told him that for some time it had seemed to me that he really was not right for the job of chief investigator. The upshot of a long conversation was that he agreed to resign. At the same time, Gervais told me about the financial problems he was having. I was just beginning a re-election campaign, and I had, at least temporarily, more cash from contributions than I needed immediately, although need for money later in the campaign was predictable. I counted $5,000 out of what I was going to deposit in the campaign bank account within the next few days. I handed it to him, emphasizing that this was a loan and that I expected to be repaid. He accepted it readily and expressed his appreciation. In early 1970, while federal agents already were constructing a criminal case against me, I became curious about what Gervais was up to since leaving our office. I was aware of his trademark, his large Cadillac, parked out in front of the Fontainebleau Motel at the intersection of Tulane and South Carrollton Avenues. He seemed to have a lot of time on his hands, yet plainly was traveling first class. I asked Lou Ivan to look into it. He began with his contacts on the police force, who knew Gervais, and in a few weeks he had what appeared to be the answer. Gervais, it seemed, had become an entrepreneur in a very unusual enterprise. His office was the lobby or the dining room of the motel, where he was available all day long. The ingenious core of his bizarre operation seemed to be the historical fact that he used to be my chief investigator and also knew half the police force. Pershing Gervais apparently had become a master of what is known as playing results. He would select a criminal case, which he learned, either from friends on the police force or from court attachés, was not very strong, in which the district attorney's office had a low probability of winning. His next stop was to contact the family of the defendant and inform them of his special connection with the district attorney. After gaining the family's confidence, Gervais would advise them that, despite the serious charges against their son, it was possible for him to arrange for the DA to lose the case. Let us say, for the sake of argument, the DA's office lost 2 out of 5 such cases in court after a jury trial. Gervais would then call the families of those who were acquitted and announce his success in arranging the outcome of the case. He would collect from them $5,000 or whatever the name fee happened to be, part of which, he would imply, was to go to the district attorney as a payoff. Evidently, Internal Revenue Service agents caught on to what he was up to and developed a case against him. As it turned out, playing results was just the beginning of Gervais's suspicious activities. He also collected large amounts of money from various individuals for authorizing everything from the operation of a house of prostitution to the opening of a massage parlor to the running of a high-stakes gambling game. By the time the federal agents had completed their investigation against him, they appeared to have had him in a very tight vise. And because most of his activities were based on his presumed close relationship to me, they also realized that Gervais was a potential way for them to get at me. At first, we learned from the papers we obtained under the Brady Rule, Gervais informed the IRS agents that there was nothing he could tell them about me because I would not take money and he could not get me to do anything illegal. However, as the vise was tightened, they learned about the money I had loaned Gervais. That was what the federal agents had been looking for. It was all they needed to start building their fictional structure of bribery. Sometime in early 1971, Gervais dropped around and explained to me that he had come into some good fortune. Friends in the pinball business helped him in an enterprise, the particularities of which he never got around to describing. However, his point was that at last he was going to be able to pay back some of the money he had borrowed from me. He would not be able to pay it all at once, but from time to time he would give me $1,000. This seemed agreeable to me, and I let the subject drop from my mind. After that, Gervais would come by the house to see me occasionally, only now he was wired for sound, with the transmitter taped under his shirt and a receiver at some outside location, such as in the car of a federal agent near the house. Inasmuch as I had just undergone painful back surgery, I usually was in bed during his visits. He would ask me how I was feeling, and there would be a brief conversation about nothing in particular. Then he would say something like, "Incidentally, I have another $1,000 for you. What would you like me to do with it?" My usual reply would be something like, "Just put it on the mantle." These conversations, of which I recall 3 or possibly 4, presented a problem for federal agents. In every case, they lacked a peg, something that could give Gervais's handling of $1,000 to me a sinister meaning. There was no discussion of my helping the pinball operators violate the law because he knew, perhaps then better than anybody, that I would never go along with such a thing. However, when listening to copies of the taped conversations, which we had obtained under Brady, we found that in every tape a lively line or two had been inserted at just the right spot so as to give the rest of the conversation its sinister context. I happen to remember clearly one of the final conversations that Gervais taped. It had gone along these lines. Gervais says, "You know, this coming legislature in Baton Rouge could be tough. Some of my friends in the pinball business will really need some help." Garrison, "What are you telling me for? Why should I help them?" I remember the conversation because of my long-standing and pronounced lack of interest in dealing with the legislature. Except on a rare occasion when, for example, I went up to Baton Rouge to obtain a law preventing felons from carrying loaded revolvers. Consequently, I was profoundly astonished when I listened to the copy of the government's tape of this conversation. What I heard, in the presence of attorneys from Lee Bailey's office and my own, was not what actually had been said, but rather the following. Gervais, "You know, this coming legislature in Baton Rouge could be tough. Some of my friends in the pinball business will really need some help." Garrison, "I don't see any problem. Forget about it." I could not recall from what other tape the new response had been obtained, but it was instantly clear that the reply supposedly coming from me had been inserted. We were appalled that the government would go so far, but I was pleased at the obvious desperation of its agents. If they were this hard up, if they had to be so downright sleazy in their attempt to develop evidence against me, then that meant that their case against me had to be pretty pathetic. My trial was an elaborate government tableau in the tradition of Franz Kafka. The great issue to be determined was whether or not I had been a corrupt district attorney. They, the Justice Department, ultimately chose, on August 20th, 1973, to begin the trial, which was expected to last 4 to 6 weeks. The election, in which I would be running for a fourth term, was scheduled for November 10th. That meant I would be lucky to have 5 or 6 weeks afterwards to campaign, although at least 4 or 5 months usually is necessary in New Orleans. Even before the opening of the trial, my major opponent, a former assistant United States attorney, began appearing on television spots. His advertisements provided the public with a colorful contrast. Every morning I was featured on the front page of the Times-Picayune as the defendant in a squalid federal bribery case. Meanwhile, every evening there was Mr. Spick and Span on television, calling for a return of decency to the district attorney's office. This was the setting for the case of the United States of America versus Jim Garrison et al. The et al. Was legalese for my co-conspirators, most of them men I had never set eyes on before my arraignment. There's an author's note here, let me read this. All of the defendants, except myself and two others, Aaron's Gallery and Robert Nims, were, in fact, pinball owners and or operators. And by the time the case came to trial, they had pleaded guilty to one charge or another. Gerald Gallinghouse, the United States attorney, announced that he personally would be in charge of the prosecution of the trial. All that meant to me was that his judicial district would be totally without the services of a United States attorney for perhaps 6 weeks. However, he obviously recognized the paramount importance of this pinball case to the Justice Department, and he made his presence known through the pretrial activities. A sheaf of legal papers always in his hands, small American flag ever present in his lapel. The judge was Herbert Christenberry, at the time the senior judge of the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Louisiana. There were far more complex and significant cases on the docket, but he moved them aside to devote his next 6 weeks or so to this pinball question. Judge Christenberry was an austere, stone-faced individual whose stolid expression concealed a volatile temper. Years before, when I was in private practice, I had stood only a few feet away in his court office when he hurled a large law book at a co-counsel of mine who had protested the charge Christenberry had given the jury. He would have thrown one at me as well, but he had none left on his desk. Christenberry also happened to be the judge who signed the order enjoining me from prosecuting Clay Shaw for perjury in spite of the valid federal statute explicitly forbidding federal interference with a state prosecution.
More than 2 years after my arrest, trial day finally arrived. My wife and children came to the door as I was about to leave my house that morning. Liz was still in her bathrobe, trying to control the tears welling in her eyes. My children were still very young at the time. Young Jim was 14, Virginia 12, Lion 10.5, Elizabeth 9, and Darrow 7. The children sensed that something was happening, but were not sure what it was. They would later learn in the day when my wife brought them to court. I kissed them all. "Don't worry, I said. This is just another day for the DA's office. At court, as the bits of business which mark a trial's beginning were getting underway, I informed Judge Christenberry I was going to represent myself during the trial. The judge promptly ordered all attorneys to meet him in the conference room. In the smallish chamber, to which the courtroom led directly, I sat down on one side of the table with my attorneys, Lewis Marriage and Fred Barnett. The United States attorney and his two assistants sat on the other as we waited for the judge. The prosecutors were looking at me in utter disbelief. All they had ever known me to do as district attorney was to farm out my cases to trial specialists. They had never heard of me during the preceding years when I had earned my keep trying jury cases every day. My decision to try the case myself had been made after waiting, along with Lee Bailey's attorneys, through the mountain of material which represented the government's case against me. It had become increasingly apparent that the whole affair was a fabrication consisting of two separate parts. The first, some sort of financial arrangement which undoubtedly had pre-existed between a number of the pinball operators and at least one member of the police force, was the large one. This pinball arrangement apparently did constitute a conspiracy under the technicalities of federal law, and that made it of value to the federal government if, somehow, it could be connected to my coattails. And that's where Pershing Gervais and the government's doctored tapes, the second part of the prosecution's case, came in. This was the small case which they wired to the larger pre-existing case to make the big bomb which they were going to haul into court. It was plain to me that the government's fraud in connecting me to the pre-existing pinball case had been a criminal activity. However, I also realized that this was almost too much to ask the members of a jury, who had grown up under a government they regarded highly, to believe. An out-of-town lawyer, even one with the great ability of F. Lee Bailey, might not be able to communicate the essentially unbelievable fact of the government's corruption in setting me up. That was when I decided that I had to do it. I knew that most New Orleanians had to be aware of my long fight with the federal government. I knew that most of them sensed, even though they might not know all the details, that my motivation was genuine. Consequently, I concluded, my defense should be nothing less than a continuation of my fight against Washington, with me doing the fighting. Now Judge Christenberry strode into the chamber and seated himself at the head of the table. He was not enthusiastic about the development, but there really was not much he could do to prevent me from representing myself. He listened as I explained that, while I felt my representation had been excellent, we had a difference of opinion as to how the trial should be handled. Marriage and Barnett confirmed this. Judge Christenberry turned to me and said that he would go along with my motion to represent myself, so long as I had another attorney at the defense table. He emphasized that he could not have the records show that he let me go to trial unaided. That was fine with me. When the trial resumed, my longtime friend, Lou Marriage, was seated at the defense table by my side. The government's first witness was one of the owners of the pinball machines. I had never seen the man before, nor had I ever seen anyone employed by him, and he had never seen me. Gallinghouse, the United States attorney, a large, imposing man in a dark blue suit, carefully drew his testimony from him. Yes, the pinball operator said, he had contributed to a fund intended to minimize law enforcement interference with pinball operations in the city. To whom did that money go? To Sergeant Fred Soule of the New Orleans Police Department, the operator replied. The time came for cross-examination. Time for cross-examination. To whom did Sergeant Soule give the money? He had no idea. Had he ever given any money to me? No, he had not. Had he ever given any money to anyone connected with my office? No. Had anybody in my office ever done any favors of any kind for him or his pinball business? No one had. there were no further questions. One pinball owner after the other testified, and the pattern continued. Same questions on each direct examination, same answers. Same questions on each of my cross-examinations, same answers. The next morning, I brought a book to court. Lou Marriage picked it up. "What's this?" he asked. "Something for me to read," I said, "while the United States Attorney continues with this pinball case. Do you really expect me to go along with the pretense that all of this testimony is relevant to anything?" "You can't do this in Christenberry's court," he said. "He'll stop you." "No, he won't," I replied, and he did not. I sensed that the judge was restless at first, as I read while the owners testified at length, but apparently he got used to it. Later on, as the seemingly interminable testimony continued, I glanced at the jury. I saw several of its members yawning. When each machine owner completed his tedious direct testimony, I put my book down and questioned him briefly. I established that we did not know each other, that neither I nor my office had ever done anything for him in connection with his pinball business, and that he had never given any money to me or to anyone representing me. Having established the total irrelevance of the witness insofar as I was concerned, I dismissed him, picked up my book, and resumed reading it. Finally, the government finished with its parade of pinball machine owners. "Call Sergeant Frederick Soule," Gellinghouse announced. Soule was a smallish, mustachioed man, neatly dressed and wearing a bow tie. He perched carefully on the edge of the witness chair like a parakeet in a birdcage. His testimony for the prosecution added up to a confirmation of his being the receiver of protection money from the pinball owners. The high point was his acknowledgement that he had saved up his part and buried it in a large container in his backyard. After his arrest, he dug it up and turned it over to the arresting authorities. His testimony corroborated that the owners had paid into a protection fund, but it never brought out who had received the money from him and what they did in exchange for it. In short, it did not address the performance end, which completed the bribery transaction. I knew from the witness list that the government was not going to call any other officers from the police force. So, I had reasoned, the action on the law enforcement end would have to come from Seoul. It never came. Thus, the cross-examination of Sergeant Soule turned out to be unexpectedly brief. The former police commander of the Vice Squad testified that I had never asked him to do anything improper. He testified further that my office had never had any prior knowledge of pinball raids, and that we had a high percentage of convictions in pinball cases. Now it was time for the star witness for the prosecution. "Call Pershing Gervais," Gellinghouse announced in a stentorian voice. After some bustle around the entrance doors to the courtroom, Gervais appeared. His hair was gray now, and he was huskier than he had been in our early army days back at Camp Shelby. He was natty in a cream-colored knit suit, matching shirt, and dark brown tie. He was wearing large, steel-rimmed glasses. Casually strolling down the aisle, he seemed as much at ease as if he were a member of the United States Attorney's staff. He made himself comfortable in the witness chair, then nodded at the members of the jury with a broad smile. I listened carefully to Gervais's lengthy testimony. Gellinghouse, well aware that the trial had been going for some days without my name coming up once, made the Gervais presentation the crown jewel of his case. The full details of how the written recording micro... I'm sorry. The full details of how the hidden recording microphone had been taped to Gervais's body were described. Then the tape recordings were introduced as evidence and played for the jury. Every juror, the judge, the prosecutors, and I all wore earphones while the U.S. attorney labored at converting overnight a misdemeanor involving the pinball machine owners and a police sergeant named Soule into a major bribery conspiracy involving the district attorney. And with the magic of electronics, he made distinct progress in that direction. My stomach turned each time I heard my voice on the tapes follow Gervais's innuendos with remarks such as, "Sure," and "Sounds all right to me." I knew, of course, that each phrase had been selected from another tape and had been taken completely out of context, but the jurors did not. The agents of the intelligence community engineering this particular project had done a good job not only of bottling me up, but of tightly screwing on the lid. There was no doubt in my mind that if a vote had been taken of the jurors that moment, they would have found me guilty as charged by a vote of 12-0. And I knew full well that, following their verdict, the stone-faced man in the black robe would not have sent me to one of those minimal security country club resorts to which some public figures go after a federal conviction. No, it would be the federal pen for me. Even Lou Marriage, who had made a point of always being upbeat and encouraging, was noticeably unhappy. There was very little in Gervais's direct testimony that I had not expected. But I was astonished when Gervais said calmly from the witness stand that I had received $150,000 from the pinball operators. I knew that he would have to go along with the $3,000 or $4,000 payments which matched the secret tapings of his repayments to me, but I had no idea why he had come up with an incredible sum like $150,000. However, the more I thought about it, the more I realized that Gervais's gigantic figure of $150,000 would be useful to me. The pinball people, or anyone else, for that matter, would have expected gigantic services for that gigantic amount. On the pad in front of me, I wrote, "Services?" I had the working title for the presentation of my case. I began my cross-examination of Pershing Gervais in a distinctly laid-back manner. I wanted him to sense that his testimony had not angered me. I understood the jam the IRS agents had put him in as the result of his highly original short-order brokerage operation at the Fontainebleau Motel. I also understood that he had no alternative but to answer the U.S. attorney's lengthy questioning, which set up the introduction of the government's tapes. I wanted him to know that none of this had changed me. I was still the same fellow who had served with him when we were both non-commissioned officers back in the Army days. "Do you remember," I asked, "when we first met?" "At Jackson Barracks," he said. "Do you recall when?" "It would have been prior to World War II," he responded. "Do you remember where we went from Jackson Barracks?" "I recall that we went to Camp Shelby, Mississippi." "What outfit were we in?" I continued. "The Washington Artillery of the Louisiana National Guard," he replied. I could tell from the tone of his voice that he was not on the same frequency with me. It was an evanescent warning that the relationship I thought existed did not exist anymore. I brushed it aside and went ahead. This man had been my best friend back in those early Army days. "What kind of relationship would you say we had in those years?" I asked him. "As related to what?" Gervais asked. "You recently described our relationship as being acquaintances," I said. "Would you say that when we were in the Army, we were good friends?" "My good friend was Charlie Weiss," Gervais answered me. "You were a friend. We did not socialize." That reply brought a sudden end to my being laid back. I did not know where the man had gone whom I had known in the Army, but this was not the same person at all. This man, I realized, was as cold as the steel rims on his glasses. I left the past behind and moved at once on to the subject at hand. Directing his attention to the period before he began cooperating with the government, I asked if it was not true that he had told IRS agents I was not concerned with money. He acknowledged this was true. I asked if he had not also told IRS agents that if I made a mistake on a tax return, it would be the result of carelessness, that I was just as likely to overpay my tax as to underpay it. Gervais acknowledged that he had made this statement. "Was it not also a fact," I asked, "that he had complained that he could not get me to do anything for him at all?"
He confirmed that this was correct. Now I took from the table a handful of material and walked back in front of him. I asked if it was true that the government had obtained a job for him at General Motors of Canada, and that he had to show up only several times a week to collect a salary of $22,000 a year. He answered yes to both questions. I asked what his title was. He replied that he was a division field manager, the top position at the plant. I then inquired about his qualifications for the job. When he replied that he had none, I walked back to the table. I busied myself searching through some of the exhibits. I knew what I was after, but I wanted the fact of Gervais's getting $22,000 a year for showing up a couple times a week to sink into the minds of the jurors. I picked out copies of two birth certificates and walked back to the witness stand with them in my hand where he could see them. Now I asked him whether, when he joined the witness relocation program, the government had required him to change his name. Yes, he replied, he had changed his name to Mason, and the Justice Department had given him new birth certificates for his children, bearing the new last name. I asked whether these birth certificates had shown the states in which his two children truly had been born, and his reply was that they had not. I then asked whether this necessarily meant the two birth certificates, obtained for him by the Justice Department, were forgeries. Gervais looked at the two certificates I had. He agreed that this was necessarily so. Whereupon I handed the two forged birth certificates to the jurors so they could see what a professional forgery looked like. I remained silent as they examined the artwork from the Justice Department. When the jurors had finished, I moved for a recess. I wanted the jurors to have plenty of time to ask themselves why the United States Justice Department would be so interested in convicting someone that they would have birth certificates forged to assure the conviction. I wanted them to reflect upon the majesty of the law. When Gervais resumed the witness stand, I asked if he remembered any details about the agreement he had made with the Justice Department. He indicated that he did. Then I showed him a copy of a letter written to him by John Wall, the attorney in charge of the Organized Crime and Racketeering Field Office of the Justice Department. Gervais recalled receiving the letter. That meant I could introduce it into evidence and read it to the jury, which I proceeded to do. The last paragraph concerned the conditions of his keeping the $22,000 position, referred to in the letter as subsistence, with General Motors of Canada. The paragraph said this: "It was further determined on September 8, 1971, that the subsistence is paid on condition that you not re-enter the United States without the prior approval of the Criminal Division, and that all future payments will be canceled, and the Department of Justice will be relieved of any responsibilities if this condition regarding re-entry is breached." The Federal Witness Relocation Program had been a measure ostensibly for use in the government's fight against organized crime. The change of a name for a witness, for example, was intended to protect the witness from being murdered by the mob or otherwise harmed or intimidated. To go to such lengths when the defendant was a district attorney was absurd. It seemed clear to me that the government had put Gervais into the program solely to make him inaccessible to me for interview or questioning. Although a defendant, or his attorney, has the right to interview all likely witnesses against him prior to his trial, there was no way I could locate this man, whose name had been changed to Mason, who had even been sent off to another country. Near the end of his Canadian exile, Pershing Gervais finally rebelled against the Justice Department's confinements and gave an interview in May 1972 in Canada to reporter Rosemary James for New Orleans television station. I had obtained a copy of the transcript, and now, in the courtroom, I questioned Gervais about it. I showed him the transcript, then read it aloud to him and asked him if he could confirm that he had made these following statements. Rosemary James asked him, "You were forced to work for the government?" Gervais responds,
But more than that, I was forced to lie for them. That's a better description.
Rosemary James asks him, what were you forced to do?
Gervais responds, well, it became clear in the beginning. It was obscure. It was always, you know, what we want, you know, what are we doing? See, through the beginning of harassment until that time where I, for the want of a better description, was seduced by the Justice Department, you know, if I could be seduced, as if there was some question somewhere in there, it became clear that they were really interested in but one man, Jim Garrison. And in their minds, they knew that I was the guy who could get him.
Rosemary James asks him, are you saying you got him?
Gervais responds, oh yeah, no question about that.
He recalled the interview and acknowledged that these had been his statements. Here's another comment which I requested him to confirm.
Rosemary James asks, you're giving me a lot of double talk here as far as most people are concerned. Did they want to investigate people in the pinball industry and Jim Garrison?
Gervais responds, they wanted Jim Garrison.
Rosemary James asks him, what do you mean when you say they wanted Jim Garrison?
Gervais says, they wanted to silence Jim Garrison. That was their primary objective, because if that were not true, I would still be in New Orleans.
Rosemary James responds, well, now, are you saying that you participated in a deliberate frame-up?
Gervais responds, a total, complete political frame-up, absolutely.
He agreed that these were his replies, although he suggested he might have been irresponsible to have given such an interview. Here's another series of statements which I asked if he recalled having made to the reporter.
Rosemary James says to him, what are you saying explicitly is that the government's total case against Jim Garrison is a fraud?
Gervais responds, no question about it. Anything founded and based purely on politics can't be anything but fraud.
Rosemary James asks, is it a whole lie?
Gervais responds, the entire thing.
He admitted that these were the replies he had made when interviewed. At that point, of course, the government's case against me swirled down the drain into the sewer, where it had belonged all along. But I was not through yet. Now I wanted to reveal the worthlessness of the government's fraudulently altered tape recordings once and for all. With the help of Lou Marriage, I had located an expert, Dr. Louis Gerstmann, a professor of speech and hearing science at the City University of New York. When I called Dr. Gerstmann to the stand, the United States Attorney objected vehemently. Nevertheless, the judge recognized Dr. Gerstmann as an expert in his field. Dr. Gerstmann's testimony was to the point. He had found the government's prize evidence to be a fabrication of prior tapes that had been spliced together. He cited an example of my voice being out of context with the conversation taking place. He described technical disparities occurring between my voice and that of Gervais and the recurrence of inconsistent noise levels. In sum, his testimony was explicit that the government's tapes had been doctored. I then called as a witness Leon Hubert, a Tulane law professor and former district attorney, whose testimony, essentially, was that my office had done everything possible under Louisiana law to prosecute the pinball operators. In contrast, to show the differing attitudes of other prosecutors in the state, I called the president of the Louisiana District Attorneys Association. He testified that it had been his policy not to prosecute the owners of pinball machines. I called the district attorney of Jefferson Parish, which represents the other part of metropolitan New Orleans, and he testified that his office never prosecuted pinball cases because there were too many other crimes that required a higher priority. My closing argument to the jury lasted 3 hours. I and my two co-defendants were found not guilty. There's an author's note here. Let me read it. This was not the last time the federal government tried to frame me. Along with the main case, I had been charged with income tax evasion for failing to pay taxes on the money I never received from the pinball people. This second trial was held in early 1974 after I had completed my term as district attorney. I defended myself again and was again found not guilty. The government's case this time collapsed even more ignominiously, hope I'm saying that right, than the first one had. It simply became obvious to the jurors that I had not received any illegal income from the pinball business or any other racket, and the government was unable to produce a scintilla of evidence that I had engaged in income tax evasion. Back to the text. Unfortunately, there was not sufficient time to get a re-election campaign off the ground, and my opponent won by 2,000 votes. You know, I have to say that they probably, this is me opining here, this is not the text, they probably, the powers that be, the conspirators who were orchestrating and sending their goons, like the IRS and everyone, all these bureaucrats, after Jim Garrison, they probably, their goal probably was just to get him to lose this re-election campaign, and they did succeed here, it sounds like. The whole thing, the trial was, even though they didn't have evidence, they had to have some way to, some reason to defame him in the newspapers and slander him and sling mud at him and cast doubt and aspersion on him in public. And being charged with crimes and that kind of thing, that's a great way to do it. Even back then and even today it's even worse, I'd say. The accusation is just as good as a conviction in the court of public opinion. It almost does the same amount of damage. Really, it does. Okay, back to the text. My last day in the office where I had been district attorney for 12 years was a Saturday. The place was practically deserted. The floors were scattered with crumpled paper. The waste baskets overflowed with artifacts collected by a group of people who had worked together for years. I was cleaning off the top of my desk when I became aware that Andrew Ciambra was standing in front of me. He had tears in the corners of his eyes. "Jim," he said, "I have to ask you this before I go. I've been wanting to ask you for years." I looked at him. "Go ahead," I said. "During those years when we were working on the Kennedy case?" "Yes," I asked him. "Did you really truly believe we could beat the federal government?" I put my hand on his shoulder. "Andrew," I said, "I never had a moment's doubt." Chapter 20, The Secret Sponsors. Whenever you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, how improbable, must be the truth. It's from The Sign of the Four, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Much has happened since Clayshaw's trial and my trial. Leading public figures like Lyndon Johnson, Earl Warren, Alan Dulles, Charles Cable, and Earl Cable have all died. And important characters in my New Orleans investigation, like the virulent anti-communist Guy Bannister and his private detective associate Jack Martin, have gone unnoticed to their graves. Others have died in undeniably mysterious circumstances. Lee Oswald's Dallas friend and babysitter George de Morenschild was found shot to death, a shotgun nearby, hours after arranging to be interviewed by an investigator from the House Select Committee on Assassinations. The coroner's verdict was suicide. David Ferry, as described in Chapter 11, was discovered dead in his New Orleans apartment with two unsigned suicide notes by his side. The coroner decided that the death, was due to natural causes. The deputy sheriff, Roger Craig, left Dallas and moved to New Orleans as the result of an attempt on his life. He grew homesick for Dallas, however, and moved back. His car was blown up while he was in it, but he survived. Then he was found shot to death at his home. The coroner's verdict was suicide. Unbelievable. Jack Ruby, having been treated at the Dallas Sheriff's Office for a cold, was sent to the hospital when it got worse. Shortly thereafter, it was announced that he had cancer. And shortly after that, it was announced that he had died from the cancer. Lee Harvey Oswald, of course, was shot by Ruby in front of a TV audience of millions, in a virtual wall of Dallas police officers. Though there is no mystery about the precise cause of death, Ruby's stated reason for killing Oswald, to save Mrs. Kennedy the burden of having to attend Oswald's trial, remains as questionable as ever, particularly in view of Ruby's ties to organized crime on the one hand, and to the FBI and the CIA on the other. Clay Shaw died on August 14, 1974, and the circumstances were also odd. One day, a neighbor of Shaw's saw some men carrying a body on a stretcher in the front door of Shaw's carriage house. The entire body, including the head, was covered with a sheet. The neighbor, finding this unusual, called the coroner's office, which promptly sent its investigators to Shaw's residence. By the time they arrived, the place was empty. After a day of inquiry, the Orleans Parish coroner's investigators learned that Shaw had just been buried in Kentwood in Tangipahoa Parish, where he was born. A death certificate signed by Dr. Hugh Beston attested that Shaw's death was due to natural causes, lung cancer. The New Orleans coroner, Dr. Frank Minyard, concerned about the circumstances and the speed of the burial, decided to obtain a court order for the exhumation of Shaw's body in Kentwood so that he could assure himself that Shaw had not died as a result of foul play. But before he could get the order, word of what he had in mind reached the media. Immediately, the newspapers published heated editorials protesting the callous desecration of Shaw's remains, proclaiming his right to be left in peace, hinting that this was an attempt to revive my past charges of Shaw's involvement in President Kennedy's assassination. The coroner reconsidered, there was no exhumation, and Shaw's body has been left in repose. I have no idea what happened to some of those who figured prominently in this saga. Carrie Thornley, Oswald's look-alike acquaintance from his Marine days, former FBI agent James Hostie, Oswald's friend Ruth Payne, and our witness Vernon Bundy. Some have prospered. Richard McGarrah Helms, the CIA's deputy director for plans, covert ops, when the assassination occurred, was promoted to agency director in 1966. In 1973, he retired to become ambassador to Iran until 1977, when he became a private business consultant. Johnny Carson has turned into a late-night TV icon. NBC, CBS, Newsweek, Time, Life, and the New York Times have all gone on just as before. So have some important witnesses. For example, Perry Russo operates a property rental business of his own in New Orleans and drives a taxicab on the side. Julia Ann Mercer, married to a successful businessman, is a housewife in the Midwest. And Pershing Gervais is a bail bondsman in Baton Rouge. With one exception, the members of the special group in the New Orleans DA's office who carried out the JFK investigation are still involved with the law in one way or another. Andrew Ciambra is now a magistrate in the Criminal District Court in New Orleans. Lou Ivan is a member of the state legislature. Al Ozer became a judge of the Criminal District Court until his retirement and is now a senior partner in a New Orleans law firm. Jim Alcock also became a Criminal District Court judge in New Orleans and now practices law in Houma, Louisiana. Charles Ward sits as a judge on Louisiana's Fourth Circuit Court of Appeal. D'Alton Williams practices real estate law in New Orleans. Numa Bertel is chief of the Indigent Defender Service at the Criminal District Court. Frank Klein returned to our office and later moved on to become the chief assistant district attorney in Plaquemine Parish, south of New Orleans, but I'm sad to say he died of cancer in 1986. As for myself, following my defeat for a fourth term as district attorney and my acquittal in the government's phony tax evasion case against me, I spent 4 years in private law practice, wrote a novel, and then was elected to my present offices as a judge on the Louisiana Fourth Circuit Court of Appeal. However, my interest in the assassination of President Kennedy and its implications never ended. The assassination critics have continued to turn up new information, which has continued to be disregarded by the United States government. To me, Among the most significant revelations were the belated discovery that an additional bullet had been found in President Kennedy's body at the autopsy scene, the disappearance of President Kennedy's brain, and of course the confirmation by both Victor Marchetti and Richard Helms that Clay Shaw had been an agent of the Central Intelligence Agency. In 1978 and 1979, the House Select Committee on Assassinations conducted its hearings, and while well on its apparent course of attempting to breathe new life into the moribund Warren Commission report, stumbled reluctantly to the conclusion that Kennedy was probably assassinated as the result of a conspiracy. There's an author's note here, let me read it. The House committee was left with no other alternative after its acoustics experts discovered that, in addition to the shooting from behind President Kennedy, a rifle had been fired from the grassy knoll in front of him. Nevertheless, the committee concluded that the frontal shot had missed completely, so Lee Oswald remained the killer of President Kennedy. This was a roundabout way of saying that the Warren Commission was really almost right, except for the detail of the extra rifleman up ahead. The committee added that it was theoretically possible for the grassy knoll rifleman and Lee Oswald to have acted independently, in which case there might not have been a conspiracy after all. Okay, back to the text. Before disbanding, it called upon the Justice Department, this is the House Select Committee on Assassination, that is, to consider reopening the investigation, and delivered a secret report detailing the fresh leads its work had developed. The result of that request was nearly a decade of silence. There's a note here, let me read it. It was broken, rather anticlimactically, in September of 1988 by the news that 6 months earlier the Justice Department had advised the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee it had found no persuasive evidence of a conspiracy. Back to the text. More than anything, what has changed in the years since President Kennedy's assassination is our national consciousness. We've been through so much. There were, for example, the assassinations of MLK, Robert Kennedy, Medgar Evers, and Malcolm X. There were the assassination attempts on presidential candidate George Wallace and on Presidents Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan. We have lived through 9 horrifying years of the Vietnam War, the trauma of Watergate, the revelations during the 1970s about the CIA, and more recently, the Iran-Contra affair. This extraordinary succession of events has ended our innocence. Looking back today with new information and new insights, it is possible to put together an informed historical speculation of what happened to President Kennedy and why. I believe that what happened at Dealey Plaza in Dallas on November 22, 1963, was a coup d'etat. I believe that it was instigated and planned long in advance by fanatical anti-communists in the United States intelligence community. That it was carried out, most likely with official approval, by individuals in the CIA's covert operations apparatus and other extra-governmental collaborators, and covered up by like-minded individuals in the FBI, the Secret Service, Dallas Police, and the military, and that its purpose was to stop Kennedy from seeking détente with the Soviet Union and Cuba and ending the Cold War. A coup d'état has been described as a sudden action by which an individual or group, usually employing limited violence, captures positions of governmental authority without conforming to the formal requirements of for changing office holders as prescribed by the laws or the Constitution. A successful coup requires a number of elements: extensive planning and preparation by the sponsors, that would be those responsible for the coup, collaboration of the Praetorian Guard, officials whose job it is to protect the government, including the president, a diversionary cover-up afterwards, the ratification of the assassination by the new government inheriting power, and the dissemination of disinformation by major elements of the news media. If this concurrence of events has a familiar sound, it is because this is exactly what happened when John Kennedy was murdered. There's a note here, a historical note, about the Praetorian Guard. Let me read it. During the Roman Empire, the Praetorian Guard constituted the imperial bodyguard. These carefully selected special soldiers, led by high-ranking officers of the Empire, were the only troops in Rome. Some of them were always with the Emperor no matter where he was. As a consequence, in a crisis, they could make or break the Emperor. Back to the text. I do not know precisely when the planning and preparation for the coup began. In a sense, it may have been as early as late 1960 when the CIA prepared a dossier analysis on the president-elect. Such a psychological profile surely would not have contemplated the assassination of the president, but its purpose was to help the CIA, or some elements within it, further its goal of manipulating foreign policy. It probably was not until later, when Kennedy had veered toward détente and conventional means of controlling policy had failed, that assassination became an option in the minds of some of the CIA's Cold War establishment. Just who did the plotting is not clear either, but certainly Guy Bannister was involved in questionable assassination-related activities very early. Representatives of his organization, Friends of Democratic Cuba, were the first ones to impersonate Lee Oswald when they tried to buy 10 pickup trucks for the Bay of Pigs invasion from the Bolton Ford dealership in New Orleans in January of 61. By the summer of 1963, Bannister was deeply involved in anti-Castro activity, ranging from training guerrillas north of Lake Pontchartrain to collecting ammunition for raids on Cuba. That Bannister was working with the CIA at this time is no longer open to serious dispute. Another one of Bannister's tasks that summer of 63 was sheep-dipping of Lee Oswald to make him appear to be a dedicated communist. Although no one has ever succeeded in locating a genuine New Orleans chapter of Fair Play for Cuba, Bannister had Oswald out on the streets handing out leaflets in its name. He provided Oswald with a room up on the third floor of the Newman Building and met with him from time to time in his own office. This sheep-dipping with courtesy of Bannister, succeeded exactly as planned. Following the assassination, Oswald was immediately branded a communist, with his leafleting activity in New Orleans cited as the prime evidence. See how that works, folks. The sponsors of the assassination also arranged numerous scenes where Oswald was impersonated in hopes of laying a trail of incriminating evidence at his feet. The most significant of these impersonations occurred in Mexico City in October of 1963, when Oswald reportedly contacted the Soviet embassy and the Cuban consulate, ostensibly to arrange a trip to the Soviet Union. The reason this particular impersonation stands out is that all the documentation, quote-unquote, for it was provided by the CIA. This evidence, which included CIA memos, photographs of a man who obviously was not Oswald, and tapes of phone calls to the Soviet embassy that were not in Oswald's voice, were insultingly flimsy. To me, this meant that while some elements within the CIA participated in the Oswald impersonation charades, and thus were doing the necessary preparatory work of setting up the scapegoat for the assassination, other elements within the agency remained uninformed about the plot, or indeed might have been trying to discover the truth. Oswald appears to have been extensively manipulated by the CIA for a long period prior to the assassination, and may well have believed that he was working for the government. Oswald was also an FBI confidential informant, a job that provided additional control over him and may have given him a reason to believe he was actually penetrating the plot to assassinate the president. His association with the FBI raises a question. To what extent did the FBI and the Secret Service cooperate in the pre-assassination planning? It appears to me that neither agency took any discernible positive action prior to the assassination, although there clearly was distinct inactivity when activity was called for. This brings us to the second necessary element for a successful coup, the cooperation of the Praetorian Guard. A coup d'etat needs the support neither of a large number of government officials nor of a broad base of the population. The managers of the coup may well represent the views of only a tiny minority of the populace, but if they have key elements of the Praetorian Guard on their side, the majority becomes irrelevant. In the U.S., the modern counterparts to the Praetorian Guard are the secret police of the intelligence community, beginning with the smallish, close-at-hand Secret Service, and extending on through the FBI, the intelligence divisions of various federal departments, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the Central Intelligence Agency. Without key elements of this modern-day Praetorian Guard, a coup d'etat in the U.S. would be impossible. With them, however, a coup can be unstoppable. The Praetorian Guard is vital to a successful coup because it has the capability of allowing the defensive protection of the leader to vanish at a crucial moment. The removal of the Emperor Caligula in seconds, leaving as the new emperor the stuttering Claudius, was almost casual following the quiet withdrawal of the protection of the guard, and almost equally casual was the removal of President Kennedy in less than 6 seconds, leaving Lyndon Johnson as the new president. A telexed warning of an attempt to assassinate the president in Dallas on November 22 or 23 had apparently been sent to every FBI special agent in charge across the country and had been quietly ignored. The protective bubble for the president's limousine had been left off by the Secret Service. The windows and roofs of buildings along the parade route had not been secured. And the parade route had been changed at the last minute so that the motorcade would have to make a sharp turn, thus slowing it to less than 10 miles an hour. All of this added up, essentially, to the withdrawal of the president's protection by the modern-day Praetorian Guard, leaving him vulnerable to the rifle fire coming at him from the grassy knoll in front of him and from at least 2 locations in buildings behind him. Precisely how many shots were fired, from precisely where, and by whom, are questions that remain unanswered. But one thing I'm quite sure of is that Lee Harvey Oswald did not fire at anyone on November 22, 1963. His negative nitrate test, his abysmal marksmanship record in the Marines, his generally unaggressive personality, the poor quality of the Mannlicher Carcano rifle he allegedly bought through the mail and used, and the lack of any evidence of his involvement in the Tippit murder all confirm that he killed no one, that he was merely, as he claimed, a patsy. The president's blood hardly cooled before the well-organized cover-up began. The hijacking of his body in an ambulance to Air Force One, over the vociferous objection of the Texas officials at Parkland Hospital, allowed the body's quick removal before the required local autopsy could reveal that he had been hit from both front and back. Lyndon Johnson was promptly sworn in as the new president to head off the alarming possibility of a national security emergency. Then the plane made its getaway from Love Airfield and headed for the military autopsy waiting at the U.S. Naval Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland. There, the Hippocratic Oath and any serious search for truth would suddenly be swept aside in the face of the first rule of the military, to obey orders without question. Once Air Force One took off and Kennedy's body was airborne, it finally could be announced officially that the president had been shot only from behind. It could be announced that a lone assassin, a disoriented young Marxist drifter with no motive and no supporters, had done it all, and that the Dallas police already had him under arrest in the office of Captain Wolf Fritz, the chief of homicide. The feared emergency was over. The United States government was in good hands. The coup d'etat had accomplished its objective with clockwork precision. The life had been ripped from the chief executive of the United States government, and major changes in American foreign policy would be arriving not in months or weeks, but in the next several days. Meanwhile, the cover-up was progressing. The Secret Service sent Governor John Connally's clothing, along with all the evidence it contained, to be laundered and then proceeded to scrub down the presidential limousine, again washing away crucial traces of blood, bone, and bullets. Later, its agents would investigate Lee Oswald's office and Guy Bannister's operation and fail to find anything remotely suspicious. How convenient. The FBI hushed up the fact that it had been informed of a plot to kill the president 5 days before the actual assassination and began bullying witnesses like Fenella Farrington and trying to silence others like Richard Randolph Carr. It went so far as to alter the statements of witness Julia Ann Mercer, who identified Jack Ruby as the man she had seen, dropping off a rifleman on the grassy knoll an hour before the assassination. The Dallas Homicide Unit managed to lose two rifles found in the Texas School Book Depository, one of them being a highly accurate 7.65 Mauser. It never bothered to check out Deputy Sheriff Roger Craig's report that he had seen a Nash Rambler station wagon carrying four men, including Oswald, leave from in front of the depository and even denied hearing of such a thing. It concealed for 10 months Oswald's negative nitrate test. It concealed, altered, and fabricated crucial ballistics evidence in the Tippit murder. And most important, it allowed Jack Ruby to kill Oswald in the basement of police headquarters, surrounded by dozens of officers. Jack Ruby had at least helped set up the assassination, and because of this, may have been put in a position by the assassination's engineers where he had no alternative but to eliminate Oswald. Ruby's act of violence, silencing the one man who might have identified the assassination sponsors, was the capstone of the cover-up. With the cover-up such a stunning success, the stage was now set for the ratification of the assassination. The surviving elements of the new government, from Lyndon Johnson, J. Edgar Hoover, and Earl Warren on down, were quick to see the advantages of supporting the scenario that no coup d'etat had occurred and that our democracy was safely intact, that a lone malcontent had murdered the president in a meaningless, random act of violence. And they were quick to understand the message of those who had engineered the assassination, that this was a forceful consensus that wanted the Cold War resumed at its pre-Kennedy intensity. There is no evidence that Johnson, Hoover, Warren, or Allen Dulles had any prior knowledge or involvement in the assassination, but I would not hesitate to classify all of these men as accessories after the fact. As soon as the non-participating elements in the intel community saw that a coup d'etat had occurred, they moved quickly to support the official story. Motivated in some instances by self-preservation, and in others by a belief that Kennedy had brought the assassination on himself by compromising too often with the Soviets, the remainder of the government, from high elected officials to heads of departments and agencies, lined up to add their solemn voices to the growing chorus chanting the great lie. This is the way of all successful coup d'etats. In the early 17th century, Sir John Harrington, the English poet, described it in a few lines. Treason doth never prosper. What's the reason? For if it prosper, none dare call it treason. The beginning of the formal ratification process came when Congress allowed President Johnson, the heir to power, to appoint the Warren Commission, including ex-CIA Director Allen Dulles, to investigate the murder. The Commission's report, carrying the prestige and credibility of its highly respected chair, put the official government stamp of approval on the lone assassin fairy tale. For the government, reluctance to face the pre-assassination involvement of the CIA and the participation of its other intelligence agencies in the cover-up, such a ratification must have seemed the easy way out. For many years afterwards, federal officials did their best to prop up this crumbling edifice as critics tore it apart, leaving almost no one still believing in the lone assassin scenario. With the murder plainly unsolved, a succession of presidents and attorneys general, each with the resources of the FBI and the entire federal government at their command, made no effort to get to the truth. On the contrary, when I attempted a real investigation of the assassination, federal officials sought to suppress the truth. I received no cooperation when I sought to subpoena key witnesses like Allen Dulles. I found crucial federal records destroyed, altered, classified as secret, or sealed by the federal government for 75 years. I found myself denounced by the president, the Attorney General, and the Chief Justice. I found my investigation infiltrated and subverted by federal agents, and ultimately I found myself on trial in a trumped-up federal case. This is what happens to you when you do not go along with the new government's ratification of the coup. The government's cover-up and ratification of the assassination have been aided by a flood of disinformation appearing in the major media. Dissemination of disinformation is the last element necessary for a successful coup d'etat, and it also happens to be one of the specialties of the CIA. For many years, the agency secretly had on its payroll journalists ostensibly working for the major media, but in fact disseminating propaganda for consumption by the American public. It has also subsidized the publication of more than 1,000 books. As Richard Barnett, the co-director of the Institute for Policy Studies, put it, "The stock in trade of the intelligence underworld is deceit. Its purpose is to create contrived realities, to make things appear other than they are for the purpose of manipulation and subversion. More than 200 agents pose as businessmen abroad. The CIA has admitted that it has had more than 30 journalists on its payroll since World War II. Proprietary corporations, Air America and other agency fronts, fake foundations, student organizations, church organizations, and so forth, are all part of the false bottom world that has ended up confusing the American people as much as it has confounded foreign governments." For 25 years, the American people have been bombarded by propaganda pointing insistently to a variety of irrelevant false sponsors as the supposed instigators of the Kennedy assassination. A false sponsor is a term used in covert intelligence actions which describes the individual organization to be publicly blamed after the action, thus diverting attention away from the intel community. Americans have been so thoroughly brainwashed by such disinfo, paid for by their own taxes, that many of them today are only able to sigh mournfully to one another that they probably will never know the truth. Meanwhile, an unending stream of news service releases, newspaper articles, TV documentaries, magazine features, and books repetitively reinforce this bewilderment and continue to point the public's attention in the wrong direction. The incredible accumulation of false sponsors laid upon the American people include Lee Harvey Oswald, the KGB, Howard Hughes, Texas oil barons, organized crime, and Fidel Castro. The original false sponsor was the scapegoat himself, Lee Harvey Oswald. Nominated for the role by the intel community, he was formally endorsed by the Warren Commission and others at the highest levels of the U.S. government. However, over time, it became increasingly apparent that the lone assassin fairy tale had fallen apart, and most of its supporters simply fell silent. Consequently, I was surprised to find recently that Time magazine, long an ardent supporter of the lone assassination explanation, continues to be loyal to the original false sponsor, Lee Oswald. One must acknowledge a certain magnificence in the total dedication here, the sustained lack of thought through 25 years. In its August 1, 1988 review of the novel Libra by Don DeLillo, which, although fictional, is an interesting and provocative treatment of both the Kennedy's assassination and his alleged assassin, Time finds fault with the book's argument that the plot to kill Kennedy was even wider and more sinister than previously imagined. There's a simpler possibility, the magazine authoritatively concludes. A frustrated, angry man looked out a window, watched the president ride by, and shot him dead. When I read that brief, neat disposition of one of history's most complicated and significant events, I realize that there is not much one can say to a publication which obviously has all the answers. One of the most intriguing false sponsors is Fidel Castro. Frequently over the years, particularly when I was making speeches at universities, I would encounter people who enthusiastically agreed with me that it was not possible for Oswald to have killed Kennedy unaided. However, they then would add that they believed that Fidel Castro had engineered the assassination. I would answer by examining the logic of this proposition. First, I would point out that at a critical time during the CIA's attempted invasion of Cuba in 1961, the acting chief of the agency beseeched the president to provide jet fighter plane support from nearby U.S. Navy aircraft carriers. Kennedy refused, and the invasion failed catastrophically. Next, I would explain that during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, Kennedy refused to bomb or invade Cuba, as a number of his military and intel advisors urged him to do. Finally, I would remind the audience that one of the factors helping to resolve the missile crisis was Kennedy's personal assurance to the Soviet Union that the U.S. would make no further attempts to invade Cuba, a decision which deeply disturbed the operational elements of the CIA, which had been training anti-Castro Cubans at guerrilla camps in Florida and Louisiana for precisely that objective. At this point, it usually was sufficient for me to ask but one question. Do you truly believe that Fidel Castro would have liked to see Kennedy removed as president? That he would have preferred to have Lyndon Johnson in power? One could pose many more questions to those who advocate the idea of Castro as an engineer of Kennedy's murder. Could Cuban communists really have established the necessary operational base and penetration of key police elements in Dallas, one of the most conservative cities in the U.S.? Would these communists have received the extensive cooperation from Dallas officials, the FBI, the CIA, that the actual assassins evidently received? And are we really to believe that Fidel Castro had Lee Oswald hand out his inflammatory leaflets in New Orleans and later ordered the same fellow to go to Dallas and kill President Kennedy? Are we to suppose that Castro would have had only one man working for him? Fortunately, perhaps because of the very insanity of such a proposition, the false sponsorship of Castro has faded away.
I was aware, of course, of the brief vogue of the Southwest oil billionaires as backers of the assassination, that particular theory. However, this was never in vogue with me, not even briefly, because it simply did not fit my initial and unchanging belief that the critical connections were to the intelligence community. True, George de Morenschildt was in the oil business, and was a member of the Petroleum Club in Dallas. But in my talks with George de Morenschildt, it became clear to me that he was used, not by the Southwest oil billionaires, but by the intelligence community. His duties were limited to escort supervision of Oswald, at the conclusion of which he was dispatched to his government-oriented business in Haiti, while the final arrangements were made establishing Oswald as the scapegoat for the assassination. The visit of Jim Braden, or Eugene Hale Brading, to the offices of the Hunt family of Texas Petroleum fame a few days before the assassination appears to have been a one-shot deception gambit. The same kind of one-time visit to the Hunt offices was made, also just before the assassination, by Jack Ruby, who was no more in the oil business than Braden was. The intention of these decoy moves was to fuel speculation that the Texas oil business might have sponsored the assassination. Such brief decoy visits reminded me of the misdirection move with which every major professional football team commences a number of its running plays. Upon receiving the ball, the runner takes half a step to his left, and while the opposing defense is off and running in the wrong direction, then heads off to his right at full speed. The professional football players, however, are only amateurs when it comes to misdirection. The real pros work in the Operations Directorate of the Central Intelligence Agency. Of course, the primary and most lasting false sponsor has been organized crime, the mafia, the mob. Many of the books ostensibly criticizing the government's official explanation of the assassination seem designed simply to leave readers with the firm conviction that the mob murdered JFK. As with any powerful myth, there are some elements of truth to it. The CIA has worked with the mafia over the years, and there is certainly evidence that many mob figures hated President Kennedy and his brother, Attorney General Robert Kennedy. And mob-related individuals do figure in the scenario. For some elements of organized crime, pre-Castro Cuba had been rich pickings with its wide-open gambling for American tourists. Later, in furtherance of its private war against Castro, the CIA made arrangements with some of these mobsters, most notably Santos Traficante and John Roselli, to help it accomplish the assassination of Fidel Castro. Other mob-oriented individuals, like Jack Ruby, were still adept at collecting arms and ammunition for anti-Castro adventures. It was hardly surprising then, after President Kennedy's murder, that the agency continued to use its helpful new friend, the mob, for the fragrance its very name provided as a false sponsor. The unarguable criminality of its varied enterprises added greatly to the continued confusion being manufactured by the agency's disinfo machinery and caused many eyes to turn away from the company as a possible sponsor. For these mobsters, in turn, the agency had become a new and generous godfather. The agency used its new friends not only for murder and gun running, but for other purposes as well. Imagine my surprise, for example, upon thumbing through a volume of the House Select Committee on Assassinations when I read a report provided by the CIA. It stated that, quote, Jim Garrison, while still district attorney of New Orleans, had participated in a secret meeting in a Las Vegas hotel with John Roselli, end quote. Of course, this was absolutely false, but I considered it no small honor to have the disinformation machinery of the government's main clandestine operation smear me with its most powerful potion, association with the mob. There's an author's note here, let me read it. The periodic allegations that I am on friendly terms with organized crime figures are amusing, in light of my record. As District Attorney of New Orleans, I ended the lottery racket for the first time in a century. I cleaned up the Bourbon Street clip joints for the first time in anyone's memory, and I closed down the last houses of prostitution in the city. In a town where no district attorney had ever before been re-elected, the citizens of New Orleans kept me in office for 12 years, three full terms. In 1987, after 10 years on the appellate bench, I was re-elected to another 10 years without opposition. The citizens of New Orleans obviously are as amused by the absurdity of these mob charges as I am. It has been my policy not to respond to each of the many canards which have been part of the campaign to discredit my investigation, nor to waste time trying to prove negatives. For what is it worth, however, I do not even know Carlos Marcello, the man with whom I am most frequently linked by my detractors. Nor, for that matter, did I ever in my years as district attorney come upon any evidence that he was the mafia kingpin the Justice Department says he is. It's the end of the note. Let me go back to the text. Far more significant than this minor slander has been the agency's success in persuading many otherwise thoughtful Americans to believe that organized crime itself somehow accomplished the sophisticated social engineering that resulted in the elimination of President Kennedy. I suggest that we examine this contention with a little old-fashioned reasoning. It will be recalled that the original route scheduled for the motorcade did not go right past the Texas School Book Depository,
where Oswald had been working since October when Ruth Payne obtained a job interview for him there. In fact, as late as the morning of the assassination, the motorcade route was still diagrammed on the front page of the Dallas Morning News as continuing on Main Street to the center of Dealey Plaza. Is it really believable that the mob could have changed the route of the motorcade on the morning of the assassination? Never mind the succession of books which purportedly reveal organized crime as the engineer of Kennedy's murder. If it can simply be shown how the mob changed the route of the motorcade on the morning of the assassination, just that one simple, single item, I could accept at least the possibility that the mob killed President Kennedy. Without that explanation, I must be suspicious of the people who say they believe the mafia carried out the assassination. It appears to me that someone with considerable force and influence wanted to have Lee Harvey Oswald close to the motorcade. Whoever this was decided, in effect, that if we can't put Lee Oswald along the parade route, then we'll put the parade route next to Lee Oswald. Who could more likely accomplish that change? The capos working for Anthony Fat Tony Salerno, or clandestine operations elements of the intelligence community? The employees of Tony Accardo, known as Big Tuna, or the elements of the Praetorian Guard, which, having the duty to protect the president, also have the power to decide when, where, and how he travels. Placing Lee Oswald somewhere along the parade route would have been of value only to whoever had sheep-dipped him to appear to be a communist and supporter of Fidel Castro. Was it organized crime that sheep-dipped Oswald, or was it Guy Bannister, veteran of the Office of Naval Intelligence, FBI, and the CIA? Was Oswald working out of some mafia restaurant, or was he working out of Guy Bannister's offices along with David Ferry, a small army of anti-Castro Cuban guerrillas, and a host of intel community operatives? Could organized crime have ensured that the version of the front page of the Dallas Morning News offered to the Warren Commission as evidence no longer showed the originally scheduled route of the motorcade? Could the mob have obtained Governor Connally's clothes, sending them out to be dry-cleaned after the arrival of the president's limo at Parkland Hospital, thus removing all evidentiary marks? Could the mafia have whisked Kennedy's body away past Texas authorities who wanted it kept for the local autopsy, as Texas law required, and got it aboard Air Force One? Could the mafia have placed in charge of the president's autopsy an army general who was not a physician? Could the mafia, in the course of the autopsy, have ordered the pathologist not to probe the neck wound lest a bullet from the front be found lodged in the spine? Could the mafia, afterwards, have ordered the chief pathologist, Commander Humes, to burn his original autopsy notes? Could the mafia have arranged for President Kennedy's brain to disappear from the National Archives? Upon close examination, then, the false sponsors all fall of their own weight. What remains is the only likely sponsor with both the motive and the capability of murdering the president is the covert action arm of the CIA. Invisible as it is dangerous, the covert operations apparatus of the CIA has become far and away the most powerful element in the intel community. It is the closest to the top levels of the government and, at least since the 1950s, has assumed a steadily increasing role in the determination of foreign policy. As distinguished from intel collection, covert operations includes the development and distribution of propaganda, the euphemism here is disinformation, the raising of secret armies, the staging of coup d'etats, and even murder. Everywhere and anywhere, internally and domestically, as well as internationally. But it's always hidden. Such concealed operations represent more than two-thirds of the CIA's total activity, as a result of which the Covert Operations Directorate constitutes, as former CIA officer Philip Agee once put it, a secret political police, the Gestapo and SS of our time. It is improbable that an elaborate plan to assassinate the president received official approval from John McCone, the CIA director in 63, or Richard Helms, the deputy director for plans or covert ops. But it may well have been conceived at lower echelons of the agency and been carried out in collaboration with extra-governmental individuals or organizations. There's a note here on organizations. Let me read this. The most obvious of these were the anti-Castro adventurers, both Cuban and American, whom the agency had trained at its guerrilla camps north of Lake Pontchartrain, and mob-connected individuals like Jack Ruby. Back to the text. But it may well have been conceived at lower echelons of the agency and been carried out in collaboration with extra-governmental individuals or organizations, precisely to avoid leaving any paper trail to top CIA officials who may have conveniently looked the other way. We have recently seen such a quasi-governmental creature, composed of a mixture of government officials and private citizens, in the Iran-Contra affair, which Congress investigated in 1987. That particular mixture of official power and civilian assistance, also seen in the Watergate affair, was described by one of the high-ranking officers participating in it as the Enterprise. I believe that the Iran-Contra Enterprise may well be the historical descendant of a considerably more powerful enterprise that killed President Kennedy. Both were brainchildren of the CIA, Covert Action Directorate. Both utilized a combination of agency veterans and mysterious civilians to carry out their sinister illegal operations. Both were steeped in far right-wing ideology, and both were totally unaccountable. The continuity here is frightening indeed. To me, it appears that the dream of the late CIA Director William Casey of an ongoing off-the-shelf operation to handle extremely delicate and controversial covert actions as an untraceable instrument of the agency has been a living reality for a quarter century, going back at least to the assassination of President Kennedy. Unlike the false sponsors, the CIA clearly had the capability to accomplish the assassination. In 1975, a Senate committee headed by Frank Church found that the agency had planned a number of assassination operations using everything from poison to machine guns and sometimes mob hitmen. The committee was not mandated to inquire into domestic assassinations, but it did find that the agency had repeatedly conspired to remove foreign leaders who were implementing policies it did not like. In 1953, with Alan Dulles directing the operation by radio out of Geneva, Switzerland, the agency launched a well-organized coup against the government of Iran. As a result, Premier Mohammad Mossadegh was overthrown, the imperial throne was restored, and the Shah was reinstalled on it. In 1954, in Guatemala, Jacobo Arbenz, although not a communist, was governing with distinctly liberal policies. When some military leaders began a plot against the democratically elected leader, the agency moved in to support them with armed fighter planes. Arbenz ended up fleeing the country. In 1960, Patrice Lumumba, a strong national leader and the first premier of the Congo, which is today Zaire, became an agency target. Like Mossadegh of Iran and Arbenz of Guatemala, Lumumba was not a communist. Nevertheless, CIA Director Dulles authorized the expenditure of up to $100,000 to remove Lumumba. Shortly thereafter, the agency's deputy director for plans, Richard Bissell, asked CIA scientist Joseph Scheider, to make preparations to assassinate an unnamed African leader. Scheider made a list of toxic biological materials which would cause fatal diseases indigenous to Africa. In his testimony before the Church Committee, Scheider admitted delivering a lethal bouquet to the agency's station chief in the Congo and instructing him that he was to assassinate Lumumba. However, the poison never had to be used. In January 1961, Lumumba, now temporarily out of office and a political prisoner, was placed on a plane allegedly bound for Bakonga in Katanga province. In mid-flight, it was redirected to Elizabethville in the same province, an area where the inhabitants were known to be hostile to Lumumba. Some weeks afterwards, it was reported that Patrice Lumumba had escaped but then had been murdered by hostile villagers. The CIA's direct involvement in the murder of Lumumba is unclear, but in 1978, former CIA Africa specialist John Stockwell, said a high agency official had described to him how he drove around with Lumumba's body in his car, trying to decide what to do with it. The church committee found that, in addition to plotting the murder of Patrice Lumumba, the CIA on a number of occasions plotted the murder of Fidel Castro, using such novel devices as poison diving suits and toxic cigars. Furthermore, the committee found that the agency had actively encouraged the assassinations of other foreign leaders, including Rafael Trujillo of the Dominican Republic in 1961, President Ngo Dinh Diem of South Vietnam in 1963, and General René Schneider of Chile in 1970. The committee's sobering conclusion was that the CIA repeatedly had planned or helped plan the assassination of a number of national leaders. There's an author's note here. Let me read this. This did not include the systematic assassination of tens of thousands of village leaders and suspected Viet Cong carried out in Vietnam under the CIA's Operation Phoenix. Back to the text. This was confirmed by former agency officials. According to one of them, William Harvey, the CIA's program of removing foreign leaders included the capability to perform assassination. Richard Bissell, former deputy director for plans, covert ops, also acknowledged that assassination was included in the wide spectrum of actions available to eliminate chiefs of state who were a problem. It seems fair to state, then, that the CIA, from long experience, had the necessary capability to assassinate President Kennedy. Equally important, it had the motivation. Contrary to what most Americans assume, the CIA was not created solely to gather intelligence. From its beginnings in 1947, the primary reason for its existence, as exemplified by the dominant role of its operations directorate, was the defeat of what it perceived as a monolithic communism. The hardline Cold War obsession of the CIA during the Truman and Eisenhower years, that the Soviet Union was committed to the destruction of the U.S. and the conquest of the entire world, was shared by its brother agency, the FBI, under J. Edgar Hoover, and by many others in the government. President Kennedy had campaigned and taken office on a note which suggested that his administration would continue the policy of no compromise with the Soviets. However, it gradually became clear that his philosophy did not truly lend itself to the long-established hard line. From his refusal to let General Cable have the requested jet fighter support for the agency's faltering Bay of Pigs invasion, to his rejection of the recommendations to bomb and invade Cuba during the missile crisis, to his insistence over the initial opposition of his military advisors that the U.S. sign the nuclear test ban treaty in Moscow, to his decisions in 1963 to withdraw from Vietnam and consider restoration of diplomatic relations with Cuba, Kennedy was following a different drumbeat. There's a note, author's note here, let me read this. Actually, Kennedy seems to have had very little real support in Washington for the policy of military restraint to which he had come by 1963. His own Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, acknowledged in 1984 that as late as 1965, he was convinced that the U.S. would win in Vietnam. Dean Rusk, President Kennedy's Secretary of State, made a similar acknowledgement. One has to wonder just who in the U.S. government in 1963 did support Kennedy's lonely decision against our continued military involvement in Southeast Asia. To the hardline, war-oriented elements of the American power structure, for whom the CIA Operations Directorate had been created and firm for whom it functioned, this was nothing less than selling out to the communists. In retrospect, the reason for the assassination is hardly a mystery. It's now abundantly clear from the course that the U.S. foreign policy took immediately following November 22, 1963, why the CIA's covert operations element wanted John Kennedy out of the Oval Office and Lyndon Johnson in it. The new president, elevated by rifle fire to control of our foreign policy, had been one of the most enthusiastic American Cold Warriors. Although, as vice president, he had become, of necessity, a closet cold warrior. Lyndon Johnson has been described by writer Fred Cook, a highly regarded observer of the Washington scene, as a man with a limited knowledge of foreign affairs, who by experience and temperament was oriented to think in military terms. Johnson had originally risen to power on the crest of the fulminating anti-communist crusade which marked American politics after World War II. Shortly after the end of that war, he declaimed that atomic power had become ours to use, either to Christianize the world or to pulverize it. A Christian benediction, if there ever was one. Johnson's demonstrated enthusiasm for American military intervention abroad, which earned him the title the Senator from the Pentagon, contrasted starkly with President Kennedy's intention of total withdrawal from Vietnam. It was no surprise then that following President Kennedy's death and Lyndon Johnson's swearing in as president, some dramatic changes in American foreign and military policy took place. Kennedy's order to have the first 1,000 Americans returned home from Vietnam by December was promptly rescinded. Of even greater consequence, on the Sunday afternoon following the assassination, after solemnly making an appearance at the eulogy for Kennedy at the Capitol Rotunda, Johnson met with Henry Cabot Lodge, the U.S. ambassador to South Vietnam at the time, in the executive office building. He informed Henry Lodge that he was not going to lose Vietnam, that he was not going to see Southeast Asia go the way of China, and that Saigon can count on us. In August of 1964, the Gulf of Tonkin incident occurred, or at least, so the American public was told. The entire affair carried the musky fragrance of the intelligence community. While on routine patrol in international waters, it was announced from Washington, the U.S. destroyer Maddox underwent an unprovoked attack. An invisible enemy vessel, it seemed, had fired an invisible torpedo, which fortunately missed the Maddox cruising off the coast of North Vietnam. Shortly afterwards, a similar incident took place involving another U.S. Navy vessel. Once again, the enemy, deceptive as ever, left no evidence of the attack. Johnson soundly denounced this open aggression. He appeared on national TV to inform the Americans that renewed hostile actions against the United States ships on the high seas in the Gulf of Tonkin have today required me to order the military forces of the United States to take action in reply. Yes, that's my terrible LBJ impression. Congressional leaders of both parties, he said, had assured him of passage of a resolution making it clear that our government is united in its determination to take all necessary measures in support of freedom and in defense of peace in Southeast Asia. The Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which passed on August 7, 1964, with only two senators dissenting, gave Johnson the power to take whatever military action he felt necessary in Southeast Asia. This declaration of war against North Vietnam, however unofficial, had been accomplished just over a year after John Kennedy's American University speech, in which he had eloquently expressed his hope for peace. Promptly following the congressional resolution, American planes began their first bombardment of North Vietnam. The U.S. Pacific Command was ordered to prepare for combat. In 1965, more than 200,000 American troops poured into South Vietnam. In 1966 and 67, upwards of 300,000 more followed. By the time the U.S. signed the Paris Agreement in January 1973, more than 55,000 Americans and millions of Vietnamese were dead. Thus was President Kennedy's foreign policy reversed without conforming to the formal requirements for changing office holders as prescribed by the laws or Constitution. That's the very definition of a coup d'etat. This was the major consequence of the assassination of John Kennedy and the real reason for it. Is all of this plausible? It might not have seemed so 25 years ago. However, now that we know some of the true history of the CIA and its covert operations, the answer is a distinct yes. Assassination is precisely what the agency knows how to do and what it has done all over the world for policy ends. With the passage of time, we can see the enduring results of President Kennedy's assassination. The nation is still recovering from its tragic 9-year adventure in Vietnam. The CIA continues to run our foreign policy without any real control by either Congress or the President. Only now the agency stands far back in the shadows, appearing to distance itself from the enterprise at hand, using private citizens and intermediaries to guarantee its insulation. The Justice Department, knowing all that we know now, still refuses to conduct an honest investigation into the most important political assassination of our time. 25 years after President Kennedy's murder, it may be too late. However, it is not too late for us to learn the lessons of history, to understand where we are now, and who runs this country. If my book can help illuminate this for a younger generation who never knew John Kennedy, then it will have served its purpose.